emailed me already talking about Bernie Sanders calling Donald Trump a pathological liar.
Little side note, not the first time. First time he said it on Fox News, on the Fox channel, yes. First time maybe a lot of people have heard that, but not the first time he said it. In fact, Sanders has said that, well, pretty consistently for the last 2+ years. Just kind of throwing that out there as a little bit of reality for those who are shocked by the senator calling Donald Trump. And look, the response, not surprising either. Nobody on the stage was actually shocked. So, again, not something of a surprise. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world. And in New York City, our chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, Luke Vargas. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
So did you happen to see the Bernie town hall on Fox News last night?
I watched some parts of it. I mean, it's just so amazing how thin-skinned the president is. He's tricked himself into believing that his viewpoint on issues is the majority viewpoint because he's not testing himself in any other forum.
Right.
I mean, I was just looking. Emerson College had a poll out today saying 47% of Americans support building the wall, but 45% oppose that. I mean, that's a healthy, you know, point of conversation. It's not, there's not uniformity on that. The Kaiser Family Foundation did a poll a few weeks ago asking whether Americans favor or oppose a national health plan in which all Americans would get their insurance from a single government plan. In 2008, 2009, that was the last time opposition was in favor ahead of those who favored it. Now it's 56% support national health insurance versus 39% who oppose. So it shouldn't be a surprise when you pan the cameras over a crowd and people are raising their hands saying they want to get rid of the current system. And Pew, I noticed, had a poll recently that said the percentage of adults who say abortion should be legal is at a 30-year high now of 58%, with opposition at a 30-year low of 37%. So, you know, it was kind of an amazing instance where Fox News, which I feel like often just tries to deliberately distort the playing field of American political discourse, had a kind of sobering moment, and the president sort of got to see it as well, to realize, oh, no, you know, not everyone is in step with you on all these issues. Now, is this going to prove to be quite as much of a boon for other Democrats that want to replicate Bernie here and go on Fox? No. I think what Bernie's really got is that he has a authenticity about him when he speaks about these issues. I was at Cory Booker's campaign launch in Newark over the weekend. It was one of the lamest political events I've been to, and I've covered, you know, 500 of them since I started doing this in 2007. And, you know, you put Cory Booker or Kirsten Gillibrand or someone else on a Fox News town hall meeting, and they're going to be revealed as speaking in that horrible politician-y way that people just roll their eyes about. But it is pretty cool to see someone like Bernie breakthrough. And the reason it works is because it's the same reason the way it worked for Trump is that, you know, Bernie and Trump target these people who are not traditional voters. And they're the kind of people that actually might be watching Fox who might have their minds changed. You know, Booker and Gillibrand and Liz Warren, some of these other people, I don't think are going to ever convince someone who just happens to be a disaffected former Democrat who's now watching Fox. They're not going to get won over by that. But there is something special about Bernie, and it will be funny to watch everyone else now, you know, have their press people call up the executive producers at Fox and Friends, and they're going to be shoving Democrats in front of that camera. I don't think it's going to go well for most of them, like it went well for Bernie yesterday.
But I've been saying for years that, you know, the Democrats need to be in that forum. They need to be presenting their ideas and fighting and doing all this stuff. So when Sanders said he was going to do it, I'm like, that's a great thing. Because you're right. I think he has been that more independent and willing to, you know, to speak out and be more authentic. This is a guy who, up until a couple of years ago, was carrying a brown bag to lunch every day.
Yeah, look, you're going to need to win this election in a lot of different ways, but I think you're correct in so far as saying that a good nominee on the left is going to have to be comfortable going into Fox News, and it's going to be one of many, but probably a pretty good criteria of who in this crowded field has got the chops. From watching Pete Buttigieg, I think he definitely has the ability to change the way he talks, to inspire a really diverse group of people. I think Amy Klobuchar has shown she can do it. In fact, maybe some of the professional baggage that she carries in terms of being sort of an abusive boss in some ways and very exacting, and in another strange way, could be maybe a a calling card to say, hey, I'm no pushover. I fight literally and, you know, fight for what I believe in. There's a different ways of getting there, but you're right. I am looking at this big field, 15-plus people. I don't think many more than 3, 4, or 5 people are going to really pass that test, and that might be one way in which we start to, you know, sort of
weed some of them out.
Yeah.
At the end of it, I have full disclosure, I'm a Sanders fan. I haven't chosen who I'm going to vote for yet in the primary, but I voted for Bernie in the last primary. Would have voted for him in the general without question. In fact, he was the very first person that I ever interviewed when I did this program 14 years ago.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm on that, on the Bernie side.
Yep.
Because he is that kind of authentic, even though now they're trying to paint him as this super rich millionaire, which is kind of laughable on a certain level. But, you know, just it's funny, and we'll see where it takes us. But I think the money is also going to play into this, because we've seen, this Buttigieg guy, up until a couple of days ago, I didn't even know how to pronounce his name. And he's ahead of Elizabeth Warren raising money.
Yeah, so we have, they call it the money primary, right, where we're trying to look at first quarter fundraising and see what we can glean from it. I'm a little skeptical of judging on any one criteria, but, you know, and the polls are definitely a part of that, but you can't discard any one criteria either, and I think fundraising is sort of illustrative here. We have Sanders in the lead at $18 million raised over the first 3 months of the year. That's a little more than half of what Trump pulled in, $30 million over the same period, but in a crowded field, it's impressive. You have this sort of first tier, as I see this, comprised of four people. Sanders at $18 million in the first 3 months, Kamala Harris at 12, Beto O'Rourke at 9, and Buttigieg at 7.1. And then it really starts to trickle, you know, go down pretty fast from there. But what's fascinating is, you mentioned Buttigieg, you know, he's spending his money really wisely. Someone calculated his burn rate, i.e. the amount that he's spending compared to the amount that he's pulling in. He's only spending less than 10% of what he's raising, and a third of what he spent, $700,000, went to processing fees on his donations. So he's really not like one of these guys who's out there spending heavily to try and build name recognition. He's finding, and this is, again, and I think this is a Bernie thing, it's a Trump thing, and it's a Buttigieg thing, which is that free press,
yep.
You know, he can't put a dollar on that. And the fact that Buttigieg can go on Fox and generate headlines, he can go on Morning Joe and do it, that he can do it on his campaign launch, which really broke through, I thought, in social media over the weekend, that's invaluable in an election like this. And some expenditures maybe on the worrisome side, Liz Warren spending 87 cents on the dollar and maintaining a staff of 160 full-time people on payroll, that is double Bernie Sanders and quadruple Kamala Harris. 160 full-time staff for Elizabeth Warren, spending about 90% of what she's bringing in. That's risky early on. And it really is the kind of strategy that's only going to work if you really know that you're going to be able to catch fire and keep up the fundraising. Because that is, I believe, something like $2 million in salary every 3 months. You know, this is going to be expensive as it gets going. I'm not sure if that's the right strategy or if it's going to be sustainable. Amy Klobuchar, another bit on the expenditure part, spending $625,000 on acquiring lists of possible Democratic voters and potential donors. A suggestion to me that she's looking at both low polling plus the new Democratic criteria to get into the debates. You've got to raise from 65,000 individual donors, and probably says, I've got a few million from big backers here, but I do not have broad support. I'm going to need to pay to get the data to try and target my message.
Yep.
She's several steps away from putting all the pieces together. And then finally, small contributions versus big donors is a big debate fissure that we saw between Bernie and Hillary a few years ago. It's definitely a race where we can sort of sort between people who have grassroots appeal. Bernie Sanders, 84% of his donations coming in small donations. I believe that's under $200 per person. Andrew Yang and Liz Warren, both above 70%. And then swing far to the other side, and I'm not surprised to see the names who are not pulling in much money from grassroots supporters and are mostly counting on big donors. Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, only 10% of his contributions are small donations. Gillibrand and Booker at 17 and 18%. You know, these are people in the New York metro area that have long courted, you know, Wall Street and the pharmaceutical industries, and that's where their money's coming from. I think they've got big problems if they can't build that out. You know who's in the sweet spot? Kamala Harris. raising about equal amounts of money from small donors and big donors, $7.6 million from people donating over $200. So that's useful. I mean, we talk about Buttigieg and some of the other folks like Sanders in terms of, you know, what they can get without spending money. But if you're going to spend money and you're going to need to keep raising, that Kamala Harris sweet spot, I think, is a good sign for her. So we're already starting to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff here.
Yeah, and then what happens when Biden jumps into this? You know, how many of those people at the bottom, just the money just dries completely up?
I don't know. One calculation I saw today said that as a way of sort of pointing out that Biden is sort of falling behind here if he doesn't get in. And I do think he's falling behind in terms of the race for ideas. I think he's at an ideological deficit, and that's getting wider and wider as people like Sanders and Buttigieg sort of recast what it means to be a modern progressive or even a moderate Democratic president, which is more of what Buttigieg would be, not necessarily a progressive. I think Biden's falling behind. I saw he would need to raise $100,000 every day between now and June 30th to tie for ninth place in fundraising. That you have now something like eight or nine candidates with $7, 8, 9 million in the bank. Now, again, Biden certainly will be able to call in a bunch of favors, but he is not a guy that I imagine is going to be running one of these lean and mean campaigns either that, you know, manages its money quite in a thrifty fashion. I think he'd probably go that Elizabeth Warren route, hire the heck out of all these states and really try to hit them with a big institutional machine. You know, he would need to raise a lot to do that. And again, I'm not sure that's the best way to beat Trump. There, you know, I think other folks are showing that you do need to be able to generate your own momentum without having a big bulky campaign or a big Facebook ad buy to bolster you. So yeah, we'll see.
And look, you got to have something to run on. And you know, if you watched Sanders' things last night, you saw that people were on the were in favor of single payer. They're not. And the other message out of this is not people aren't thrilled with employer based health care, which I've been saying for years has to go. But also, you know, in that debate last night, in the town hall last night, he called on President Trump to get out of Yemen, which got a really good response from those people who were Fox viewers.
Yeah, well, and it's getting a good response in Congress. Just perhaps there are enough people who are hesitant to defy President Trump on the right with a veto override. But that's the consensus opinion. Again, it's only the sort of media echo chamber that Trump and his guys create that would make people think otherwise. It's just amazing how many issues of commonality there actually are in the American electorate that media and politicians sort of obscure from voters. I thought that was an amazing debate, and it was sort of funny to see that Freudian slip by Trump today in that tweet when he was saying, and now we have Donna Brazile, and people were saying, we? Like, he's speaking about Fox News as if it's an entity that, like, he's an employee of it. We knew there was a symbiotic relationship, and he seems to be acknowledging that was the case. I just thought that was funny because you said, you know, it was a debate last night. I mean, it was amazing that Fox has gone so far beyond journalism that Brett Baer and McCollum, I think, having really loaded questions that began with these hyper-partisanized premises that, you know, any cuts to defense necessarily mean the U.S. is weak, or, you know, that the U.S. is full and we can't take in more immigrants, so they have to go somewhere. Some people have pointed this out, that those are really, that's really biased way of interviewing
sure.
someone. But Sanders handled it very well, and that's, what you're going to have to do this year.
Yeah, and I think Saturday Night Live had it best. Michael Che on Saturday Night Live said it best when they said we're full. We've got South Dakota. In fact, we've got two Dakotas.
I know. That was great.
Not one, but two Dakotas. I wanted to get your thought on this. I just saw this the story about, I guess, Canada has signed on to this new diplomatic alliance with Germany and France. I guess it's called something like the Alliance of Multilateralism. Is this in response to Trump being just a complete idiot?
A little bit. It's a few different things. So the sort of non-Trumpian part of it is that there is, in the world of political science and international theory, this sort of notion of middle power politics, which is that if you're a country like Canada, like Germany, maybe we could throw in a few others, Mexico or Indonesia, India, you're sort of traditionally used to being powerful enough to be able to sort of move the world in meaningful ways, but not big enough and not willing to have a large enough military and military expenditures to really play around in great power conflict. And Trump has been super all about playing up great power conflict. And in fact, it's something that folks like John Bolton talk about all the time, that this is, we're really trying to craft a strategy which breaks China or does something really powerful to contain Russia as if it's a great power threat. And a lot of countries are finding that they may sort of agree with bits and pieces of what Trump is doing, but that going all in with the U.S. against China really hurts them. You know, if you're a small country, or a country like Canada, I don't want to call them small at all, but you can't get enough back from the U.S. to pay for the damage that's caused by infuriating China. And if you're Germany, you might love working with the European Union and in areas of cooperation, but you're also super concerned about Russia. You're really reliant on them for trade. And so all these countries are sort of looking for a way to gather like-minded countries together around less, you know, controversial issues, be it climate change, income inequality, dealing with, let's say, norm setting when it comes to things like autonomous weapons, what we call killer robots. I mean, there's a lot of like big policy decisions that need to be made in a diverse realm, you know, range of areas, policy setting that, you know, currently aren't being addressed at NATO or in the EU because of Brexit or at the UN because the US or Russia and China are vetoing everything. So countries are wanting to come together here. And as one political scientist in Canada explained to me, Trump, I love this analogy, Trump is like in high school when you're on the dance floor at prom and there's one kid who's like dancing like crazy and you need to sort of, he's like spinning around like a wild man and you need to get out of the way to prevent yourself from getting hit by his spinning legs. But then you also look back a few years later when you're in college and you say, that guy wasn't a nerd or a freak. He was like an amazing dancer. Like, wow, that guy was one step ahead of all of us. And that a lot of countries are sort of simultaneously trying to do damage control against Trump, but they're also realizing that he has, you know, co-opted the war of ideas, you know, and that there's a way that if countries can band together and seize the microphone, maybe you can remind the world that the majority of countries still support multilateralism, that the majority of countries want to address climate change and address all these other issues that the U.S. is too busy fighting China and, you know, to deal with. So I think it's an interesting idea. I'm skeptical because we've seen, you know, various alliances proposed in the last 2 years. One is called the Quad in Asia, which would be the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India, sort of an alliance of democracies. But again, it hinges on the U.S. wanting to be the kind of parent of this. And what I think is cool about this alliance of multilateralism is it's sort of those middle players from around the world saying, look, we don't need the U.S., we don't need Russia, we don't need China, we're not going to make this about the military, but it is about human security. It's about coming to common purpose to guard the common good, to fight for climate change, to fight against income inequality. So again, I'm skeptical this will necessarily get that far off the ground, but I hope it does. And the world could certainly use some new forums to address issues where maybe Trump isn't invited and doesn't have a chance to derail the agenda like he's been doing at the G7 meetings, you know, or in Europe, like Brexit has been doing, just distracting from the agenda. Cut out the distractions, and maybe a lot more can actually get done in this world.
Yeah, good point. And we'll see. I'm always hopeful when people are talking.
Yeah, me too.
Always. And finally, the World Health Organization published some new statistics on the increase in measles infections around the world. Just how bad is it? I mean, you know, I joke that we've got these idiot anti-vaxxers here. One woman sent out a tweet not too long ago saying, oh, there's an outbreak. How do I protect my three-year-old? Get her vaccinated, you nitwit. But yeah, I'm just curious, how bad is it?
It's bad. And the anecdote I've seen is that only 1 in 10 measles cases are ever reported. So these numbers you ought to maybe add 0.2. So the worldwide number of cases has tripled over the last year. So it's 112,000 new infections between January 1st and the end of March of this year, compared to about 28,000 over the same period last year. The World Health Organization says this is now a clear trend globally of an increase in infections. Africa is up sevenfold over the last year. The head of the World Health Organization put a pretty fine point on this. He didn't use the word anti-vaxxer. That's a little bit more of a media summation of this. But he did say that one of the problems here is a proliferation of confusing and contradictory information on the internet, and that and the UN is reminding that this disease is entirely preventable. The problem is global immunization rates are now at about 85%, which is well short of where you need to be, around 95%+ in order to get the benefits of herd immunity. Right. And so, as I think we've talked about in this program before, it always scares me that once someone, you know, is engaging in conspiracy theories, and we've seen this with Trump talking about all this debunked stuff about wind turbines causing cancer, he's literally like feeding into the craziest wings of conspiracy theory when it comes to renewable energy. He's legitimizing all sorts of other conspiracy theories, and it's so sad that it takes, you know, 100 times more corrective information to change someone's mind back once they've already been sort of lied to or misled. And it makes me nervous that as much as the World Health Organization, I think, is doing the right thing by trying to draw attention to this, I don't know if, having watched the UN operate and global health officials, I'm not sure their outreach is going to be enough to persuade people to take this seriously. So I have an unfortunate feeling this outbreak is going to get quite a bit worse before we get smart and start dealing with it. But it's getting worse, and it's getting worse everywhere. It's not localized anymore, and that's pretty concerning.
Yeah, no, I saw a sign not too long ago, about polio, and I thought polio was completely eradicated. Evidently, we're making polio great again.
Yeah, I didn't see the one about polio, but I would not be surprised, right?
No,
there's
not
no
surprised.
Reason this would stop at measles.
Yeah, but I can't tell you how many people have, over the years have given me when you were a kid. Yeah, when I was a kid, we didn't have it. We didn't have the vaccine. I would hope my mother would have been smart enough to go and get me vaccinated, so I wouldn't have had to get the mumps, the measles, and chicken pox, and all of that stuff. Just kind of a thought. I remember when all this stuff started, because it was RFK Jr. who was really spearheading a lot of this. And I remember it was right around the time when my oldest daughter was born. And, we went to my doctor, and I said, what about this? What do you think of this? And, he was very honest and very upfront. And he goes, there's some side effects from everything you're ever going to do. Do the side effects outweigh the benefits? No, you absolutely want to get your kids vaccinated. And again, he went into the herd immunity stuff and all of this. And he gave me a very cogent, reasonable, sane, rational answer. I didn't get, you're just an idiot for doing it. But, I've talked to some of these people. There's just no reaching them with common sense.
You need to tune people to a different frequency. There's clearly been a problem on the left of just in politics in general of an over-reliance on Yale and Harvard and Princeton for getting on the Supreme Court or getting elected to office. Yeah. And there has been at times, I think, a problematic intellectual snobbery on the part of some on the left. However, the degree to which Americans have been, I think, pushed to question people who sound smarter than you and to reject intellectual rigor in American political discourse is incredibly concerning, especially when so many problems require a careful study of science or at least deference to a scientific consensus. And I have to say, I know I've brought up his name a few times on this program and people are complaining that it's part of this media narrative, but I listened to Pete Buttigieg's campaign announcement over the weekend and then heard him give a speech on a rope or a remarks to a French TV network last night in French, sympathizing in a very nuanced way. This was not like French 101. He was talking about how, the pain of rebuilding is also the chance for rebirth. And I said, holy cow, this is the first, modern millennial intellectual to emerge, in my lifetime. And boy, I hope we can find a way to get a little bit more of a high-minded appreciation for intellectualism in the American electorate, because problems like, health problems, public health problems, and environmental problems, you really are going to need to defer to experts on these things. And it's quite dangerous when President Trump goes around telling everyone that, don't listen to that guy who says he's smarter than you. You know, just believe what you want to believe. It's like, it's definitely a conservative version of that accusation that people on the left are all, you know, fairies who just want to live in their own world and don't ever want to be disturbed. You know, you're really not doing yourself or this country any favors by walling yourself off to expert consensus sometimes. And again, it's going to get worse before it gets better. But boy, I hope some figures are coming on the scene who can make people admire people who know what they're talking about. That's one of the greatest advantages we have, and it's something Trump seems to really turn his nose up at.
No, not just Trump, but most conservatives that I know, because they give me the I believe stuff. No, I don't care what you tell me, I believe.
And right.
At I believe, you just, there's no reasoning with I believe.
Boy.
Just is what it is. There you go. Luke, I appreciate the time, man. Always great. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Good stuff. Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Hey, listen to The Rick Smith Show.
For and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
We've lost about half of the south side of Franklin. It's totally destroyed.
Deadly swarm of tornadoes from Texas.